Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. From the Jerome L. Green Performance Space today, our street-level theater, where we are doing the show live today before a packed house, a sold-out performance in front of about 120 people, taking up pretty much all the seats we have here. And okay, 120 seats isn't exactly Yankee Stadium, but it's still a sellout, so we will take what we can get. Give yourselves a round of applause for being here today. And they deserve a round of applause because, as we all know, half of success is simply showing up, which I think is also Donald Trump's formula at the UN today. If he just shows up for the annual speech by the President of the United States and doesn't hit golf balls into the faces of the other heads of state, people will say, hey, that was pretty good. If he just shows up and doesn't say, America first, we're the world's only superpower, and you're not, nya-nya, and we're going to use all our power and all our wealth only to benefit ourselves, so take your universal healthcare systems and shove them, people will say, hey, he's really starting to get this diplomacy thing now. If he just shows up and basically speaks in empty platitudes and doesn't call Angela Merkel ugly or call Nikki Haley my Indian American over here, people will say, oh, very presidential. He didn't ad-lib off his teleprompter compy. Maybe this is a turning point in his relationship with the rest of the world. If he doesn't even give a speech, but just shows up, well, half of success is just showing up. Maybe especially in Donald Trump's case, but also for everyone else. So congratulations on being here today. Later this hour, we will stream the president's UN speech live on WNYC.org. We'll also play highlights from it here on the show. And also, listeners, we're streaming live video of the Brian Lehrer Show in the green space, as we always do when we're in the green space. So if you want to watch the radio as well as listen to the radio today, you can do that on WNYC.org or on Facebook. And you will be rewarded with great guests. We have the first dreamer, Teresa Lee, who was a child brought here illegally by her South Korean parents and was establishing herself as a talented classical pianist. Then before she could be deported, she got onto Senator Dick Durbin's radar screen and got DACA-like protection and became the model for DACA and the DREAM Act. Teresa Lee will tell her story, and she will perform on the green space piano for us as well. Also, another great immigrant, Anthony Appiah, originally from Ghana, now one of our leading intellectuals of philosophy and moral identity and law, and you might know him best more in the pop culture context of being the ethicist in the New York Times Magazine. Anthony Appiah will be here today. And our own Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, will tell us about her latest block party, where people with political differences who live on the same New Jersey block get together and share their views and try to actually come together. Nancy Solomon with excerpts from her series Block Party coming up here in the green space. And we begin with a very special guest, Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. She was editor-in-chief of Salon for 6 years. If you know her face, it's probably because she's also an MSNBC contributor and shows up there a lot. And she's the author of the book, What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. Please welcome Joan Walsh. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Brian. Thanks, everybody. It's great to be here.
Welcome back to WNYC. Is this your first time in the green space?
I believe it is, yes.
And Joan's going to do double duty for us today. We'll talk for a while now, and then later, after President Trump delivers his UN address, Joan will come back and do some analysis of it for us. You ready to do both the deep dive and the broadcast news instant analysis?
Yes, I am, because it's going to be really easy. I will not say the word pivot, but other people probably will. If he just reads the teleprompter, he's presidential.
I heard that before.
Yeah.
You don't play the piano, do you?
Oh, I dropped my lessons. Oh, my parents would be so disappointed. that I could be here and play the piano too.
All right, but we'll
leave. So only double duty, not triple duty.
Exactly. We'll leave the piano too easily.
Right.
I see you wrote an article in The Nation, and you were just on one of The Nation's podcasts saying Mike Pence would be worse for America than Donald Trump, but Trump should be impeached anyway.
More or less.
Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, we know Mike Pence's agenda is very far to the right, very far to the right, I think, of even the Republican Party. But, you know, my feeling has been we need to get to the bottom of what happened in Russia. And we may never do that. But in the meantime, I would rather have a president who is not calling the North Korean leader Rocket Man on Twitter. I mean, I think that the damage that Donald Trump can do to our country, even by, you know, retweeting a shot of him hitting Hillary Clinton with a golf ball, the constant diminishing of our culture and degradation of our culture, I think that Pence would be awful, but I also think he'd be really beatable. And, you know, the X factor with Trump, I know you all read the papers all the time and see his voters think he's doing great. And, you know, his voters, there was a piece in the Times yesterday, his voters blame the Republican Party. They're Trumpists. They're not necessarily Republicans. And so I think he's got such an X factor. I believe that Pence would be very, very easy to defeat.
Do you think the Russia investigation is going to wind up with impeachment?
I don't know. I can't say that yet. I mean, Dianne Feinstein is telling us the whole investigation could take another year and a half. I don't know. Impeachment is really a political decision as well as a legal one. So no matter what Mueller comes up with, it really depends on the wisdom and the political courage of the leadership, which is now Republican. That could change in 2018, I suppose.
You know, I try to resist the temptation to do a Russia investigation segment every day,
right?
So as to make sure we talk about the policies that really affect everyone's lives, like healthcare and immigration. But it's such a fascinating procedural day after day with Mueller and the various investigations in Congress. It's like getting addicted to Law and Order. And like when we learned recently about that meeting with Russians that took place last June, and suddenly Donald Trump Jr. and Kushner and Manafort had to go from saying we never colluded with the Russians, which they'd said about a billion times, to, well, they offered to collude and we happily accepted, but that's okay. Everyone takes opposition research. Right. Does the magnitude of the original lie get larger by the week?
Of course it gets larger, but I don't know. Because it's such a steady stream of revelations, I'm not sure we're all taking it in. And that's why I actually applaud you for, you know, not doing it every day and trying to come at it when there's something that really makes a difference or when you can sum up the threads, the trends. You know, we have now learned that Paul Manafort was wiretapped, that they got, I think, two FISA wiretaps on him. And Roger Stone is on Twitter, if you haven't been on Twitter this morning, raging about it, saying he was caught in these wiretaps. Well, yeah, you sure were. And I don't, you know, it's interesting to know that you're so upset. So the questions become, you know, was the president-elect recorded? Were his sons, his advisors, what really were they going after in terms of Manafort, and why did they did it before the election and also after the election? That implies some connection to the election, I would say.
By the way, listeners, Trump has begun his speech at the UN, and we are streaming that at WNYC.org, or you can stay with us and wait for Joan to come back on with highlights a little later in the program. So you have your choice. And again, if you're just joining us, Brian Lehrer live with you from the green space today. And when we're in the green space, we stream live video of the show, so you can actually watch the show as another choice at WNYC.org or Facebook. Speaking of which, before we get off Russia, how much do you think Facebook might turn out to be the missing link here? We don't know what happened after that Trump Tower meeting last June.
Right.
But maybe it was like, okay, great, my digital people we call your digital people, and we'll get lots of lies about Hillary out there, and then dump all these DNC emails on WikiLeaks so nobody can say it's us.
Right. I mean, the way that they released the emails, you know, starting with the first day of the Democratic National Committee convention, I was there. It's normally a time for the party to come together, and there's a real celebratory feel. It was a nightmare. It was nightmarish. Some of you might have watched it on TV. You know, there was real anger from the Bernie Sanders folks, kind of understandably, because it was too raw. No one had really analyzed the email to explain. We were just, you know, reading aloud some of the more salacious, gossipy parts. It really cast a pall on the whole week. I mean, I think they recovered. Senator Sanders did a lot to help that, and it turned into a good event. But there was always an undercurrent of, you know, unhappiness and threatened walkouts. There was a walkout, et cetera. So I think, you know, when the Access Hollywood tape, it was the same day or the next day, Access Hollywood tape comes out, suddenly someone, WikiLeaks, is leaking John Podesta's email so that we have these rival stories. And then the story that got blotted out that same day was the first time the intelligence communities came out together and said, we have evidence of Russian meddling in this election. We don't know. They wouldn't say on whose behalf, even though I think they knew. So, you know, there was just such a smart timing of the leaks. The other thing that you learn if you read about Facebook and if you read Josh Green's excellent book about Steve Bannon, even though he's gone, he still matters. They were doing so much with data, and they were bragging about it, you know, last year, and no one necessarily believed them because you can't see a lot of it. You know, they really have dark posts on Facebook, so you and I would never see ads, you know, the kinds of ads that they might have run. We learned that they were really trying to dampen African-American turnout, so African-American people might have seen those ads, and especially if they had any notion that that these Facebook users were maybe not so hot on Hillary. Maybe they were Bernie supporters, or they did a lot with Black Lives Matter content on Facebook. How do they know enough to kind of micro-target the parts of the Democratic base that were wobbly? And so it
you mean
really,
that could have come from the Trump campaign?
Yes.
Because Bannon and them were so good at micro data, micro demographics
slicing and
through
yes,
data,
yes,
feeding it,
and then Facebook
to the right
can do
people.
It. Can do it too. And I think, I don't know, some of you might have seen
not proven, but an
not
interesting
proven.
Theory.
No, absolutely. But and then the final interest, not final. There will be many more. But there was a really interesting BBC video with the woman who ran his Cambridge Analytica and what was it called, Project Apollo, which is Alamo. It's based in San Antonio, so that's really interesting politics too. And she was boasting that Facebook embedded staffers with her and really helped them hone their message. So Facebook has a lot to answer for. They did offer this kind of help to other candidates, but as far as we know, it was never as sizable as with the Trump campaign.
Joan Walsh from The Nation, our guest here in the Green Space, and listeners listening on the radio, we can take phone calls as usual. For Joan Walsh, what would you like to say or ask her based on any of her columns or her MSNBC appearances or what she's just saying here today or anything in the news today, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Green Space audience, raise your hand. We have people with microphones, and we'll come around and take your questions, too. Don't think you can come to the Green Space and just sit back and be a conventional audience. We want participation. So if you've got a question or a thought, raise your hand, and we'll get you in. Joan, your book, What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America, that came out in 2012. Considering the role of white identity politics in the election of Donald Trump, did you see it coming in some way more than others, perhaps, after immersing yourself and researching your book?
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, Donald Trump is even in my book because my book goes way back almost to the founding. I try to tell the story of how the white working class fell out with the Democratic Party over issues of race and the Vietnam War, et cetera. But I really did zero in on the last few years, the Obama 08 and then re-election. It came out on the eve of the re-election, but I got to cover quite a lot of what had gone on. And I go into the fact that Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, I'm not sure if any of the rest of the 2012 wonders, really made a point of courting Donald Trump and seeking his endorsement at a time when What was Donald Trump famous for politically? One thing, his birther crusade, demanding to see the president's birth certificate. So they were already using whiteness. They were already using identity politics. They were already using the way that Trump had so brilliantly stoked the fear and the suspicion that this we might have a Muslim in the White House. Maybe we had a Kenyan. And just the feeling of otherness that so many Republicans immediately projected on President Obama. That's why they were there.
Do you remember there was a meme for a while in 2012 during the Romney campaign, started by someone's article in some publication, I actually don't remember where, calling Mitt Romney the whitest man in America because he was like an old-fashioned 1950s dad. Does it really turn out that Donald Trump and Steve Bannon are the whitest man in America? And it actually has a whole different meaning than an episode of Father Knows Best.
Yes, I think that was funny. This is not funny. I think I termed Romney and Ryan white and whiter. But I was wrong. You could get whiter still. I think, you know, although I criticized Mitt Romney and I criticized lots of Republicans for using, we know about the Southern strategy that Richard Nixon used. It actually had a Northern component. They were really looking at those white ethnics, like my Irish Catholic working class family, luring them to the Republican Party. That all went on. But I don't think that we ever saw a mainstream non-David Duke political candidate be so willing to traffic in the fears of white people and just such ugly stereotypes about immigrants, about Muslims, about Black Lives Matter as being some kind of thuggish group. I think he really understood that you could play white identity politics much more openly than anyone had ever done it, and I think that's a lot of why he won.
Let's take a phone call. We're going to go to Joe on line 3. Joe in Cliffside Park. You're on WNYC with Joan Walsh. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. You guys had talked a little bit about a couple minutes ago about Facebook targeting, right? That type of digital marketing. That kind of strategy or tactic is available to anyone, any big brand, any individual, any political party. The implication seems to be, hey, the Republicans use this in a bad way because they use data, because they use targeting. I don't think that's true. Any expert within digital marketing knows that tactic's available to anyone. And why didn't the Democrats use it? Why didn't alternative parties use it? Is it a critique of the Republicans for using that strategy, or is it just a critique of using that marketing tactic in general? I guess I'm a bit confused what the negative part of that is.
That's a fair question. I think for me, the question is, can we learn from Facebook whether there was collusion in the sense that would be either illegal or a scandal with Russia, and Facebook isn't telling us enough to learn that? But Joan, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's one thing. You know, Facebook first said that's crazy. We had no effect. Now they've come out and said that, yes, you know, a few hundred, we found some Russian accounts. We don't, you know, it's illegal. So this is one issue. Is legality. It's illegal for foreign nationals to put money into our elections. So that's one thing. Did that happen? The other thing I would say is we have tried to have transparency in American politics, and we passed some laws regarding advertising so that, you know, a candidate has to say, and I approve this message. You know, you can have outside groups. But these kinds of ads are usually available. I'm not going to see, you know, what everyone's seeing in Wisconsin, but if I want to, I can. Scholars, reporters, other political activists can go look at the entire archive of what other campaigns have done. When you have these dark posts that literally disappear, Facebook is saying they're not even sure they can conjure them up again, or whether they feel like it's legal to do that. I think that's in a whole different category. I don't mean to sound alarmist or, you know, I guess I do mean to sound alarmist. I'll take that back.
also, foreign individuals could not go to a broadcast station and buy campaign advertising.
Exactly.
That would be illegal.
Right.
But they can do it through Facebook because it's not regulated in the same way. That doesn't exactly respond to the caller's question, which in a way is a fair point. I mean, I think you know enough political history to know that the two parties have gone sort of back and forth on who's better at a particular moment on you know, micro demographics. I think the Reagan people beat the Democrats hand down when the thing was direct mail and older technologies in the 80s. And then the Obama people with all their young tech volunteers trounced McCain and Romney in that respect. And now the Trump world seems to have beaten the Clinton world.
Right. And a lot of what they're doing is absolutely legal and fine, and they are better at it, it would seem.
I think we have a question here in the Green Space audience. Hi there.
Hi. So I was curious what you think about Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi cooperating with Trump on DACA in a way that Trump suddenly can come off as the guy who saved DACA at a time when right now people who have to reapply for DACA are struggling to come up with $495 just for the application. This has to be done by October 5th. And suddenly Trump can come off as, you know, the hero on the white horse, or maybe, you know, to be politically correct, the black horse.
And control room, cue up the Andrew Cuomo clip on Chuck Schumer and DACA that we have, and we'll play that in just a second. But Joan, what would you say to the to our audience member?
I have my worries about it too. You know, I think that a lot of the DACA folks, Pelosi was protested yesterday pretty harshly. I think that they wish that they had said, we will do nothing until we have a solution, that this vague language about, you know, Trump's support doesn't count. I mean, I believe Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are going to try to move a discharge position to get DACA, the last version of the bill, to the floor to see if it gets Republican and Democratic votes, and that will call Trump's bluff, because either he twists arms about DACA and he's tweeting about it all day, or he's not. But yeah, I think they might have settled too soon for too little. I'm not sure.
One thing that Andrew Cuomo said when he was on our show yesterday is that he seems to think Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are getting rolled. He didn't say rolled. That's my characterization of what we're about to hear. But getting rolled, in effect, by Trump on that possible DACA deal of letting them stay in the country in exchange for funding for more border security, even if not a wall per se. Listen.
In some ways, I feel like we're negotiating against ourselves. We now have DACA, right? It was done by an executive order by President Obama. But DACA is in place for the promise of, well, Congress will now confirm DACA. That just puts us where we are. And in exchange, more money for border protection, quote unquote, the wall. But not a wall, just more money for border protection. We already spent $4 billion on border protection on the southern border. How much more money than the $4 billion? And where are we going to get it from?
I guess my only reservation about his point is that we don't have DACA. It was an executive order, and this president can rescind it, and he did. He gave them 6 months to come up with a plan. So it's not as though we could just continue on with the status quo. And if Chuck and Nancy, as I guess we call them now, don't make a deal, these people will be free. They will not be. So a deal is important. The question is, how good a deal, how quickly, and have they given up some leverage that they should have held on to?
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was on our program Friday just after she co-sponsored Sanders' Medicare for All bill. And I asked her about Hillary Clinton's remark, which is either in her new book or that she said on TV in conjunction with the new book. And I know you've done a lot on the Clinton book, that Bernie was taking utopian positions while Clinton was trying to be the grown up in the room. But next to Bernie came out looking like a school mom, and it sort of wasn't fair. Here's Gillibrand's take on that.
I really think that argument's beside the point. I think Hillary Clinton inspired millions of people around the world, around the globe, by not only vying for the presidency of the United States, but working her hardest to get there. And she believed in a lot of things that most Democrats believe in. She had her own policy proposals. And I think both approaches are fine. There's nothing wrong with saying the practical approach is to get from A to B. And there's nothing wrong with Bernie saying, yeah, but my ideal is a single payer. So I don't think we should be attacking fellow Democrats on what they decide to campaign on, because that's what's coming out of their heart.
What do you think about that whole policy dynamic?
You know, one thing that I'm kind of shocked, this book has been so criticized and there's so much said about, you know, she doesn't take any blame. She really does. I have a piece in The Nation, actually a debate with a friend who's a Bernie supporter, so it's interesting. But there's a specific passage in the book that has gotten no attention where she says, I mean, first of all, she says, maybe I was not the person for this time of profound anger. But she also says, you know, it was frustrating for Bernie to always, you know, seem to be moving the goalposts, but it made me think about maybe the Democrats have lost that sense of overarching lofty policy and that we need those goals. Maybe I was so hung up on I don't want tuition-free college, but not for the rich. But we also know that some of our universal programs like Social Security and Medicare have been very hard to touch because they are universal, and that she learned that from Bernie. So it's just really frustrating to see that people, you know, wanted to pull out the joke she made about the pony, which I thought was kind of funny, but don't listen to what she says she learned. And I think that a lot of the party has learned along with her that stand up for what you ultimately believe. And if you think that the end goal should be Medicare for all or single payer, say it, but also allow for a long transition and understand what it's going to take to get from A to B to C to Z. And I think there are two approaches, actually. She was really good on A to F, you know, and he was always talking about Z. We need both in the party.
I don't know the pony joke. Is it something that can be repeated on the radio?
Yeah, I'm gonna blow it. But Bernie Sanders wants everybody to have a pony, and Hillary's like, well, but how are we gonna pay for all those ponies? And then commentators are like, Hillary hates ponies. Hashtag Hillary hates ponies. Hillary's like, no, I love ponies. Hashtag Hillary flip flop Hillary. Hillary steals from Senator Sanders. It might have one more iteration, but you get the gist. She couldn't win.
We have another question here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi there. Sorry if I sound nervous. Getting back to the Russia thing for just a moment. Given Paul Manafort's very long history going back to the Soviet era, and given that he was wiretapped before the election and after the election, how about the conspiracy theory that says he's been a Soviet spy, and then transitioned into Russia? He's been working for the Russian satellites and so on for a very long time. I think he's a Soviet spy.
That's a theory. I don't think we have evidence for that, but he does go way back. He and Roger Stone, under Ronald Reagan, set up a lobbying firm that was known as, I think, Torturers Row, because they represented all the most horrible tyrants of the 80s. He's, you know, even, I think there's some texts that somebody leaked of one of his own daughters saying, you know, we've lived on blood money. So I don't think he's a great guy, but I'm not ready to call him a Soviet spy.
On Medicare for All, or really off Medicare for All, because right now there's a bigger healthcare story, I think, than Medicare for All, which is still a long-term prospect, still a Z, as you put it, even though more Democrats are signing on. The Republicans are making one more go at repealing and replacing Obamacare before the deadline of, I guess it's September 30th, which is the deadline under the so-called reconciliation parliamentary procedure to get it through the Senate with 51 votes rather than 60. And there's this Lindsey Graham, Bill Cassidy bill that some progressives are saying might be the worst repeal and replace version yet, but might actually get rammed through without all that much media coverage so far. Do you have a sense of how big a threat that is?
I think it's a real threat. I think there has been more media coverage. I think, you know, people have been tuning in the last few days. But again, remember, just like with the House bill, the House bill's dead. Everybody goes to work on other things, and then the House bill's back and it passes. I think there's a lot of worry about that. I think, you know, I still hold out hope for John McCain because he said he wanted to do this under regular order. He said he wanted hearings. They are not even getting a CBO score to see how many people will lose their coverage or and how much it will save or cost or move money around. I heard Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin on TV this morning saying, we don't need that. We've had them already. This is a different bill. You haven't had it already. It's just so outrageous the way they bend and break the rules. And for John McCain to have come back when he's so sick, and to have made an impassioned plea for a bipartisan bill, I don't see how he votes for this.
But he's holding himself out as undecided. I know one new development is that the governor of Arizona came out for it, and that is said to be possibly influential with McCain.
He said he was going to listen to the governor for sure. He didn't say that was his only concern, but he did say that, and so that was definitely bad news. That was good news for people who want to repeal the bill.
You know, New York has a state single-payer bill with almost enough votes in the state legislature to pass. My understanding is they're about one vote shy in the state Senate. They already have the assembly. And I asked Governor Cuomo on this program yesterday, if the Republicans do break Obamacare, would you sign a state single-payer bill if the legislature actually gets one to you? And here's what he said.
If they were to pass it and it was not incongruous with what the federal government would do to us, I think it's a very exciting possibility. But I think it's going to be a federal play. And our funding system basically relies on Medicaid from the feds. And if they turn off that valve or slow that valve, there is no way we're going to be able to make that up in this state, no matter what.
And I think the key to his answer was really there. If they do break Obamacare in Washington, which would mean a lot less money from Medicaid to the states, then he's really saying no. And I know you've spoken before on this show earlier this summer about the difficulty of doing single payer on the state level.
Right. I mean, you know, he's correct in referring to it's a federal play. So many, there's like 58 different federal programs that, you know, that fund some kind of health care in this country. And so I paid a lot of attention to the California bill because it got pretty far, but it also became very controversial. Democrats really split over that bill, and the problem was that you would need waivers. You would need umpteen waivers from the federal government. You would need to keep all your Medicaid money. If you're doing real single payer, you're going to want to bring in Medicare, which I think is a little dicey. But you know, I don't think you can do that at the state level, sadly. I think Vermont, you know, great progressive state, tried it. They failed. There's just too much of a federal role between money and red tape. They both matter.
Joan, I know you're going to go and listen to Trump's UN. Oh, by the way, listeners on the radio, can you hear that? We have our first ever Brian Lehrer Show Green Space baby.
Baby.
Who's got the baby? Raise your hand so I can see you. Oh, hi there. What's the baby's name?
Amalia.
Amalia. Hi, Amalia. Amalia, you're on the radio. Okay, you're off to a good start. You can put it on your resume when you start applying for media jobs. Age 4 months, Brian Lehrer Show. All right. So, Joan, you're going to go and listen to Trump's UN speech.
I am.
And then come back with a few highlights. Here's one pull quote from the speech, which is in progress now. At least he talks in the abstract against authoritarianism when he's put on the spot like this. He says, authority and authoritarian powers seek to collapse the values, the systems, and alliances that prevented conflict and tilted the world toward freedom since World War II.
That's great. He saw those words on the teleprompter. Maybe he'll read it again when he gets home tonight and think about it.
Just promise me when you come back, you won't say he was very presidential just because he didn't call the president of Pakistan a macaca.
I promise. And no pivot. Won't use the word pivot, I promise.
Please thank Joan Walsh.